Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Poetry and Human Values, readings and discussion this week on Soundings. My guests are James Applewhite of Duke University and Richard Wilbur, former Poet Laureate of the United States. James Applewhite and Richard Wilbur appear on Soundings courtesy of the North Carolina Poetry Society and the Duke University Office of Continuing Education. Soundings begins this week with readings from their poetry by James Applewhite and Richard Wilbur. First, James Applewhite.
A leaf of tobacco is veined with mulatta hands, the ridges extending along crests of the topographical map. From the stem marking a mountainous ridge, encounter wrinkles where streams lead down toward coastal Pocosins. This time-yellowed scrap of a partial history features humans driven on like mules with no reprisal. The grit your fingers feel exploring this pungent terrain is fragments of a Staffordshire tea service buried from Sherman in fields near Bentonville. The snuff-colored resin on the ball of your finger crystallized in the corners of 75-year-old lips on the porch of a shotgun shack as she watched her grandsons crop lugs on their knees in the sun. This leaf has collected, like a river system draining a whole basin, the white organdy lead bullet, coon dog, Baptist preacher, iron plow, freed slave, raped and bleeding, dead from the lynch mob, Cottonmouth South. Scented and sweetened with rum and molasses, rolled into cigarettes or squared in a thick plug, then inhaled or chewed, this history is like syrupy moonshine distilled through a car radiator, so the salts strike you blind. Saliva starts in the body. We die for this leaf.
James Applewhite, reading from his poetry. Now, here is Richard Wilbur.
Time flowering among rocks. This, if Japanese, would represent gray boulders walloped by rough seas, so that here or there the balked water tossed its froth straight into the air. Here, where things are what they are, it is time blooming, rocks and nothing but, having nonetheless many small leaves implicit, a green countlessness. Crouching down, peering into perplexed recesses, you find a clearing occupied by sun, where along prone rachitic branches, one by one, pale stems arise, squared in the manner of mentha, the oblong leaves paired. One branch, in ending, lifts a little and begets a straight ascending spike, whorled with fine blue or purple trumpets banked in the leaf axils. You are lost now in dense fact, fact which one might have thought hidden from the sense, blinking at detail peppery as this fragrance, lost to proper scale as, in the motion of striped fins, a bathysphere forgets the ocean. It makes the craned head spin. Unfathomed time. The world's a dream, Basho said. Not because that dream's a falsehood, but because it's truer than it seems.
Richard Wilbur, reading from his poetry. Soundings continues now with a conversation featuring James Applewhite and Richard Wilbur. Their topic is the poet and human values. Here is James Applewhite.
Randall Jarrell used to say that God had taken away his readers and given him students instead, and that was 20 years or so ago. Mm-hmm. The question is the readership, I think. There's no doubt that there are many people committed intensely to the writing of poetry. And those people who write read other poets. But there's a feeling, I think, that there ought to be a broader national readership of poetry. And that's a problem that's partly a false problem modeled on perhaps a rosy view of some other time when everyone read poetry. I mean, the importance of defending human value is founded on really the defense of humanity. And if one can defend one's humanity and the humanity of one's readers by utilizing language in that primarily human fashion of its original wholeness, that's a foundation for other human values to be built upon.
All right, let's use this word that you have just brought into the conversation, Jim Applewhite. Let me put it to Richard Wilbur. What is the relationship between poetry and human values? It's not antithetical, is it?
I think what we were saying this morning, certainly what I was saying, is that although in some past ages the poet has been very clearly been an apologist for the prevailing values, has been a voice of his society, at present few poets desire that assignment, and I don't really think that our culture wishes to give that assignment to the poet, as perhaps it did in the 19th century.
So the problem is with our culture and not with the poets themselves. What are you talking about, TV?
I don't really know that there's a problem.
Okay.
I think it's possible that there is no problem. For me, the major function of the poet in relation to values is not to be an expounder of received ideas, but to be user of his complete consciousness, insofar as he can do that, who incorporates in the models of experience that he produces all sorts of value words as a matter of course, and in the process tests their vitality. Now that's a great service to society. It's perhaps much better service than standing up for truth, freedom, courage, and things of that kind.
All right. Well, you call to mind, and help me with the paraphrase here, Richard Wilbur, Jim Applewhite. Emerson says that the poet is the seer, vates, this sacred function in a society. How do you take to a label like that, Jim Applewhite?
Emerson was a romantic. This is a version of the Shelleyan poet as the unacknowledged legislator of mankind.
Mm-hmm. Emerson's very much out of fashion also these days.
It isn't just a matter of fashion. It's a matter of the broader view of history. For the most part of history, poets have not been expected to invent mythologies or to take as a special burden the kind of ideological or polemical enunciation of values as if in opposition to some threat. But it was not poetry that brought about our heightened consciousness of sexual inequality any more than it was poetry that brought about the civil rights movement. That's why should poetry have that special burden? I mean, society has to change itself.
Indeed it does. I agree with everything you say, Jim, and it very much bothers me when people try to assign the role of mythmaker to the poet. It's very nice for Stevens to say, exceeding music must take the place of empty heaven and its hymns, which is more or less an echo of Matthew Arnold.
Uh-huh.
But Stevens didn't really offer us a satisfactory myth to take the place of all that he felt had been lost.
Richard Wilbur, did you feel a special burden on your shoulders when you were the poet laureate of the United States to speak for this country or to speak to this country, to enunciate particular themes? How did all of that work?
Well, I think that it was very clearly not the assignment of the laureate to speak for the country or to respond to particular public events or crises. Robert Penn Warren, who was our first laureate, made that all very clear when he took office, and so it didn't present much of a problem for me and hasn't for Howard Nemiroff. I won't say that it doesn't touch your imagination a little to find yourself in a semi-official relation to poetry. I was glad when I took office as laureate that not long before I had written a cantata text for the Statue of Liberty.
Uh-huh. You were glad to have that behind you.
Yes, exactly. I'd shown that I could do it, mm-hmm. So that I could then announce in good conscience that I wasn't going to continue to do it.
Well, let's pursue this point, Richard Wilbur and James Applewhite. What is, if we don't want to talk about your social responsibility, what is your personal responsibility? Do you talk to yourselves? Well, I'll invite you to talk to one another about that. Jim?
Let me ask Dick to reiterate for me something of our conversation at lunch. You were describing, Dick, a village or a mall, I suppose, a pseudo-village, an ersatz village near where you live. Would you remind me briefly of that?
Yes, I think I was talking about that pleasant establishment on Stratton Mountain in Vermont, where people go in the winter for skiing and in the summer for tennis tournaments, where there are many condos.
And there was a chapel that had never been a chapel, never been prayed in? Or
yes, I think there's an ersatz congregational church there because every New England landscape is supposed to include one. But my impression was that it was a church in which there had never been a service said, or whatever the congregationalists do. There'd never been anyone married there or buried from it. The whole place was very much of a theme parkish institution, divorced from life and without a settled population of any kind.
What tell me what this has to do with your personal responsibilities as poets, Jim Applewhite?
It's a responsibility to the authentic, which has, I think, societal implications as well as personal ones. We're in a nation where the taste for the inauthentic, the glittery, the ersatz, kitsch, is, you know, remarkably widespread. And a good poem really doesn't lie and can't lie. There's an authenticity of language coupled intimately with an authenticity of feeling that's really quite the reverse of these theme parks and suddenly gotten up antiquities. The defense, I think, of a kind of central legitimacy of being human in a human world is more important than anyone recognizes. You know,
is there anything special? Let me ask you, Richard Wilbur, to follow up what Jim Applewhite is saying. Is there anything special about the South in poetic terms? We certainly look back at people like Faulkner and Wolfe and try to figure out what's special about Southern literature. What about Southern poetry?
I don't know whether I can distinguish Southern from other poetry. I do think that many of the Southerners I know are great talkers, great storytellers, and particularly capable of putting a skin on their words, of giving you a feeling that they're talking about a solid world, a world that has smells and sounds in it. There's a kind of playfulness with language that the many Southerners I can think of enjoy, and which I don't find on the whole in New York City people.
Do you find, Jim Applewhite, something peculiar, particular, something local about Richard Wilbur's poetry that you would locate it, what, in New England? Does that make any difference?
Well, I don't find it local in the way that Southern poetry may be local. I have the feeling of in a sense, a more cosmopolitan poetry, a poetry which has access to the widest possible world of intellectual and artistic reference. Part of the experience of the paradigmatic Southerner, the Southerner of my generation, is a kind of partial cultural deprivation in the early going.
In what way?
I don't mean that I, for example, did have an uncle who told me stories which later turned out to be from, for example, the Odyssey, and I thought it was very inventive of him to have come up with this one-eyed giant who had to be blinded in order to get out of the cave. But there was also a sense of an enormous kind of vacancy or erasure surrounding experience, like a kind of blackboard not much written on. It made one taste the flake of ash coming down from the fire, which was extracting the lard from the fat meat in my grandfather's backyard, or taste the tomato grown in the garden more intensely. But we weren't being taken to grand opera, and we weren't being taught Latin. There was so much we really didn't know. And in a sense, I have the feeling that the Southernisms and the things that are so popular and become, in fact, cliches for Southern literature, there's a poignance about them that we have to speak a language of barbecue and collard greens, you know. In a way, it's a flavorful, pungent language, as Dick points out. But but in a sense, it was a language in lieu of talking directly about Homer or Virgil.
Richard Wilbur?
Well, I think you gain an awful lot by whatever this lack is that you're describing. It seems to me that it's wonderful to have a language which brings you very close to the taste of ashes, doesn't insulate you from sensory things. I don't know what kind of language I'd talk. I think it's somewhat phony, actually. It's a compound of a lot of things to which I've been exposed throughout my life. In a way, I think the way I talk reflects the kind of thing I like to try to do in my poems. I like to try to combine this or that kind of consciousness in poetry. And when it comes right down to the words, I like there to be exciting shifts from one kind of lexicon to another. It pleases me when in the middle of a poem about Rome and its railroad station and its Servian wall, I can include in a line of verse reinforced concrete. I was just delighted to get that into a line of verse. And it pleases me when in a poem of mine called Love Calls Us to the Things of This World, I can almost juxtapose a great big impressive word like omnipresence, right, and another word like hunks.
Well, the meaning of which has changed considerably, I take it.
I suppose it has. Right. I just meant chunks, bits.
You have used in your conversation, Richard Wilbur and Jim Applewhite, words like the local, or I put them on the table, the universal. There is a kind of sense in the academy these days that literature is not transcendental or transcendent. It is not universal. It is necessarily political and local and ideological. Do those things concern you at all? Do you worry about them or think about them as poets? Richard Wilbur?
I don't worry about this because I have a feeling that the more, and this is very Emersonian, I think, I have a feeling that the more genuinely I talk out of myself, the more access I have to my deeper self, the more general I'm going to be. I don't try to be universal. I trust that I shall be if I'm telling the truth. And I quite agree with Jim that the main thing one has to worry about is telling the truth. Seems to me when you're writing a good poem, you can't lie. Huckleberry Finn said you can't pray a lie. Mm-hmm. And I think you can't write a lie in poetry if you're writing well.
Do you think, for example, that the critic has replaced or sits next to the poet, Richard Wilbur?
Well, I went through, as lots of people did, a period in the 1950s in which we mere poets and fiction writers were out-glamorized by the critics. People wanted to know about the life and tastes of Richard Blackmer and William Empson, and not about whether We writers drank too much or ran after women or did the other things we're expected to do. Our lives were not at that time particularly interesting. And I think perhaps we are at the moment being somewhat outshone by various theoretical critics. At any rate, I feel patronized by many of them. I think that they're not so much interested in anything I might write or my colleagues might write as they are in talking about poetry in general, writing in general, at a level well above our heads.
Well, I bring this up because one of Jim Applewhite's books that I have here in front of me, it's called River Writing. It's full of wonderful, concrete, marvelous, palpable language. And yet, in the beginning of this book, you quote from a couple of these high-powered literary theorists, Paul de Man and Jacques Derrida. Now, those aren't household names, but they are very powerful names in the academy, people who represent this theoretical impulse. You don't see a contradiction there, Jim.
Well, the point of those quotations in relation to the book is that these were the challenges that the book was an answer to. This was a kind of almost life and death grappling with the fullness of experience and the concreteness of the world to which I am desperately committed. The sense that there is a relationship between what is called signifier and signified, and that the signified is actually there, the word tree through the networking of language can sometimes relate to that particular white oak with its unique bark pattern. That's of crucial import to me. I mean, for a writer, the proposition that life experience is important to the poem, and that there is even a faculty of mind prior to language, I think, a kind of visual montage on going to sleep or waking up, for example, when things begin to move of their own, or that condition in which sometimes a poem comes and is something before language. I don't, it isn't always that, but sometimes it is that, isn't it?
I think so. I once asked that when I was very young of Alfred North Whitehead. I said, is there any kind of knowledge prior to words? And he took out his hearing aid and said, yes, there is, but I don't want to go into it.
let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Jim Applewhite and Richard Wilbur. Do you two poets inhabit or create a tradition? What do you think of yourselves in the flow of the poetic impulse? What do you think of the next generation? Richard Wilbur?
I know that that I have taken a great deal from lots of my immediate predecessors in American and English poetry. But, you know, I haven't been very selective about it. I've been influenced by all sorts of people whom the classifiers of American poets would deny me. That is to say, William Carlos Williams is one of my great loves, and I'm not supposed to belong to his school at all.
But you do.
But I belong to the school of a great many other people, so many other people that I guess I'm of no school at all.
Mm-hmm. How about this? Jim Applewhite will give you the last word.
Well, I've gone back in English literature to Wordsworth, certainly on whom I did my dissertation and from whom I've learned a good bit about structure and the whole visual presentation of the landscape that language conveys. But, you know, this issue of being a Southerner and one's relation to language is complicated, and tradition too. It is the case that actually Southerners, perhaps more Anglophile than other Americans, and Virginians, for example, molded their lifestyle on the English 18th century manner life, and that nostalgia toward England, I think, still inhabits some corner of the Southern psyche that I have inherited, and so that I've myself made my pilgrimage to holy places in England, and looked at Wordsworthian and Coleridgean vistas. But of course, I'm an American. I'm a Southern American, and the realization that It's a different language, but it's the same language, is a very complicated thing, so that when I've come back almost inadvertently to Southern writers of late by teaching a course, actually, that I was asked to teach in Southern literature, I found it strangely fructifying to be again faced with Father Faulkner Uncle Alan Tate and Donald Davidson and others. But I admire very widely, and I sometimes covet Whitman for a Southern poet, and there's one poem of Whitman's in which he longs to go back to the South, which is his home for that moment. And I want to believe Whitman in that poem, because it seems to me that there's something about the inclusiveness of Whitman that I very much admire and I think have learned from.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation featuring James Applewhite of Duke University and Richard Wilbur, former poet laureate of the United States. James Applewhite's recent books include River Writing and Lessons in Soaring. Richard Wilbur's new and collected poems were published in 1988. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 492. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, American Fiction and Literary Biography. My guests will be the novelist William Styron and the literary biographer R.W.B. Lewis of Yale University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks an anniversary for the National Bank Holiday, proclaimed by President Franklin D. Roosevelt on his first day in office in early March 1933. Of the nation's faltering bank system, Roosevelt declared, "All we have to fear is fear itself." Happy birthday this week to Vermont, which became the 14th state of the Union in early March 1791. 3 years before that, in early March 1789, the first Congress of the United States convened in New York. Winston Churchill established the boundaries of the Cold War in early March 1946 when he used the phrase the Iron Curtain. A siege of a briefer duration ended in early March 1836 when the Alamo in Texas fell to the Mexican general Santa Anna. Birthdays for early March include the naturalist Luther Burbank, born in 1849, the American Revolutionary War hero Casimir Pulaski, born in early March 1747, Yuri Gagarin, the Russian cosmonaut and the first man in space, born in 1934, and Harriet Tubman, the American abolitionist and leader of the Underground Railroad, who was born a slave in early March 1820. Finally, happy birthday this week to the Salvation Army of the United States, which was organized in early March 1880. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Poetry and Human Values, readings and discussion this week on Soundings. Listen for James Applewhite of Duke University and Richard Wilbur, former poet laureate of the United States. James Applewhite's recent books include River Writing and Lessons in Soaring. Richard Wilbur's new and collected poems won the Pulitzer Prize in 1989. Poetry and Human Values, this week on Soundings.